is an Enterprise Times podcast. My name is Ian Murphy. I'm here with Martin Jacobson, who's the Managing Director of Cybernetics, a managed security services provider. We're going to talk about the AI enablement of the SOC. Is it a saviour? Is it a distraction? Is it still a work in progress? Martin, good morning.
Good morning. Martin Jacobson, I'm CEO and founder of Cybernetics. Before I started Cybernetics, I was in network security. Government networks were built by my old business, where we came up with some of the security standards for the government. And as I moved on from that, I decided to start a new business very much focused on high-end enterprise security, mainly focused around the SOC and MDR services for the UK enterprise.
If we look at the SOC today, we're told we absolutely need AI. AI will save us. In some places, we can see that. Its ability to reduce the number of alerts, allow us to focus on what we're doing. But there seems to be almost a deference to AI growing into a lot of people's approach. How do we start to treat AI as a tool in our SOC and not find ourselves bending the knee to it?
AI needs to be seen as the next evolution of the SOC as opposed to a replacement of the SOC. A lot of people are talking about the autonomous SOC, which is nonsensical to me. If you take the evolution over the last 10 years of where the SOC's been and where it's come to, automation was introduced very early on and various people have adopted it at different levels. But we have seen an increase in alerts, in attacks over the last decade. With that, we need more tools to speed up investigations, to reduce the number of false positives, to enable the SOC to handle the alert volumes. Because one of the challenges that you'll see if you go through any breaches, quite often SOCs are tuned to a point where they've removed so much telemetry, information, knowledge, which is really crucial to identify the true attacks. You're sitting waiting for a correlation alert that's the perfect combination of events that set off a big red alert, and that's when you click the button to remediate, is not the reality anymore. You need to look for identity signals and behaviors. You need to look for telemetry around machines. You need to look at the exploitations of vulnerabilities, phishing attempts, to string together the early reconnaissance to stop it. And you need to do that at speed because the attack speed's increasing. If you look at what AI is doing, AI as a reconnaissance tool for the malicious side of cyber has vastly increased their ability to do reconnaissance, both externally but also internally. Copilot enabled in organizations will enable attackers, as soon as they manage to get a phish, to do full reconnaissance, identify service accounts, admin accounts in a matter of minutes, maybe hours. They no longer sit in an infrastructure for days to figure out what's going on. That's all sped up. What I generally feel AI needs to do is not replace the SOC, but just elevate the early detection and alert triage to make SOC analysts much more informed when they get to it. The notion that the level one SOC analyst will no longer be is nonsensical because the first human that sees it is, by the definition of the term, the level one. Level one SOC analysts, their role has changed anyway in the last 10 years. They've gone from being data gatherers from SIMs that would put information in Notepad to gather information around alert to sit with highly enriched alerts that just need to be increasingly enriched by AI now to make quicker decisions. Investigation times needs to be driven into the minutes, and AI can enable that. But it's not the savior. It will, at best, probably level the playing field with what AI is causing on the other side of the fence.
There's a whole bunch of points I want to come back on, so I'll split them up. I'm going to start with the reconnaissance point. When the recon stops, you have a very small window before the attack starts. Why are people no longer looking for those low-level telemetry signals that indicate recon? Because it's like, to me, you're saying, come on, I can take anything you throw at me, rather than, I'm ready for you and I've got my defences in preparation.
I honestly think most SOCs that didn't evolve with automation were just overwhelmed. The sheer volume of alerts that are now coming in meant that SOCs could not financially make it viable. If you're an internal SOC, you had four SOC analysts. If you're running 24/7, that means you've got one person per shift. They didn't have time to look at all of it, so they started prioritizing. Sometimes there was not even prioritization. They would tune all the lower informational severity cases and alerts out, but to the detriment of the efficacy of it. MSSPs, despite everybody thinking cyber is very important, the reality is a lot of buyers are very cost-conscious, is probably the way to phrase it. Despite them knowing the need for quality, they get baffled by a sales pitch, and then they pick the cheapest supplier. The reality is the cheapest supplier will probably also end up tuning it out. I've seen a lot of SLAs from the industry where criticals have got a 15-minute response, which is a very reasonable SLA for SOC. High severity alerts have got a 1-hour response, which is probably too slow in the modern world, but medium severity might have an 8-hour response in the SLA, and then they might not even have an SLA for informationals because they tune them out. They might not have it for low severity alerts, and they've had to do that to provide a price that was competitive. Therefore, they need to reflect that in their cost base. Without automation, the majority of SOCs have just failed in being able to deal with that.
But one of the expectations, starting with machine learning and then bringing us through into AI, was that the AI would be able to absorb all that telemetry, would be able to understand and give us more information. So if we ended up tuning those systems to only do things that we do, rather than saying, here's the gap in our system that we can't do because we don't have the time, AI can actually now fill that gap. Do we need to revisit how we see what AI can give us?
You can't really revisit AI because it's too new to revisit. So if you've already deployed it, then you've done something wrong.
Well, revisit the way we think about it.
We need to rethink where AI will enable you. From my perspective, at least what we're doing, a lot of people will have different perspectives on it. We have adopted automation very early on, and we've gone through several automation platforms to get us to a point where we can investigate. We have every type of alert. Our average response time is around 4 minutes. Average investigation time is around 19 minutes. 90-minute investigation time is a reasonable market standard. Coming back to when the reconnaissance stops, how quickly do you need to react? My view is you need to catch it while they're doing reconnaissance, because with quick remediation, you can make it very hard for the perpetrators to continue their work. If you keep kicking them out of the system for them to try and re-get access, the reality is they'll probably go somewhere else because it's easier. Build your walls higher than your neighbor and they won't attack you. But the reality for me is I'm looking at how AI can enable me to drive down my investigation time and containment time on the back of an investigation. That's where I see AI playing, because it can assimilate more data quicker than a human. But ultimately, I don't see yet an AI coming out with a determinism that says this is definitely bad or this is definitely good. Currently, with what all our testing shows, I'm not even sure I would trust it to do deterministic conclusions. At least not for good. Maybe if it's containment and the recommendation is a soft containment that's not too disruptive, you might, on the back of an AI-enabled investigation, if it says there is a 90% chance that this is malicious, you might actually preemptively hand it to a SOC analyst and say, please validate this. So at least you reacted very quickly, you contained it, or it could be as simple as, let's do a password reset. Looks like the user has been compromised in whatever way. Then the AI would have enabled it, but you still need a feedback loop to make humans get involved, because we deal with 140,000 alerts a month, roughly enough. The danger with just having AI doing everything, if that's the scenario that some people are thinking about, is how do you validate it? How do you quality check it? How do you ensure there's no hallucinations without humans being in the loop? You're going to have a diminishing quality if you're ultimately, as a service provider, there's no value to be added for improving the AI, improving the investigation mechanisms, the investigation strategies that's been taken by the AI. You need a continuous feedback loop. It's much more about driving down investigation times and creating efficiency that way instead of just handing it all over to the AI.
Now that opens up an interesting challenge here. If we're using it to augment, I absolutely understand that. If we think back 10 years ago when IBM first talked about Watson, it was very clear. Watson was a clinical assistant, it wasn't a clinician. It would provide information to doctors. And the AI, working through large amounts of data and feeding me things for me to make a decision on, makes sense to me. But where do I learn my skills, my knowledge, my ability to understand? You talk about bringing times down from 19 to 4 minutes. Me looking at the outcome from the AI and saying, yeah, that's fine, let's move with that. But I have to know that that's fine. I have to have acquired the knowledge enough to be able to look at what's given to me and know first that it's not trying to blow smoke up my backside, and secondly, that that is a realistic expectation from all the pointers it's given me from the data of what action should be taken next. How do you continue to train staff to make that determination when in other fields we're seeing people abdicating that decision to the AI?
In terms of a preconditioned LLM pandering to your thoughts, needs, and whatever happened last, when you architect an AI SOC, you need to make it very clear that every alert has to be investigated without premonition or learnings from earlier cases, because the reality of the world is that 99.99% of all alerts are false positives. If you take an LLM and ask it the statistical probability of whether something's a false alert, it would say 99.9 and it'd be correct. The SOC's first role is to identify that needle in a haystack and bring that to light and escalate or contain that particular issue. You can never have an LLM that starts using earlier investigations as a deterministic factor for what the current one is, because that has all sorts of problems. So that's in terms of what technology you use and how you set it up and how it's trained and how it models things. Coming back to how do you train your SOC analyst, that challenge with the volume that's been increasing has been there for a while, because level one, firstly, it's a very uninteresting job. It's an entry-level job in cyber. A seasoned level one analyst is not really a concept that exists anymore. Historically, when you had a couple of alerts a day, you could have a seasoned level one analyst because they would sit and do a five-hour investigation into things. That is now what's considered a tier three, are the ones who get to deep dive into things. The way we've solved it with automation before LLMs, we have some battle-hardened, gray-haired security people who built the automation playbooks that aggregates data, that finds entities, that does thread into lookups, but also gives the guidance of why was the first 85 automated deterministic steps done and what are you looking for next. We're then releasing more and more alerts into the level ones we introduce into the SOC. They start with some simple use cases, how to use, and they cut their teeth on those. Let's say they qualify, they elevate themselves, take the McDonald's models, they go from fries to burgers, and they go a little bit more complicated as they go along. We have created a bit of a machine for doing that with training. But the LLMs, when you build an AI engine, you need to make sure that you need to have the logic behind the investigation. There needs to be determinism that's created in your SOC or by your SOC architecture that you could feed to the SOC and say, why is this case even created this way? What are you looking for? Then with volume, they will train on it, and they will learn why the LLM is doing it. Ultimately, SOC analysts or anyone else, we're getting to a world where it's not about knowing anymore. It's about being able to ask the right question or prompt for the right data. Knowledge is not the value anymore. It's the ability to find it and request it in the right way.
You talked several times already about automation. One of the things that we want the system to do is, what can I automate? What can I take the grunt work off of people so people can find, A, something that interests them, because then they're going to be engaged with the job, but B, something that accelerates what we do. But automation assumes proven workflows. Automation assumes, often in most organizations, static workflows, not continuously evolving workflows. You mentioned just there that you tell the LLM it's not going to look at previous alerts and investigations, is going to treat each one uniquely. But with each investigation, there'll be a lot of repetitive steps within that automation. That takes time. That takes processing power. How do you balance that out? Because that's cost to the business. That's cost to the client down the line.
Our approach and what we got running in our test environments is, for an alert type, we build out two sequential strategies. One is, what's the information gathering strategy? Then what is the analytical strategy on top of that? The first time an alert is done, we build out a deterministic data gathering strategy for it. We might use an LLM to create that strategy the first time, but second time around, we use deterministic workflows. It goes into a deterministic analytical engine that brings out all the insights from that, and then that feeds into an LLM. It means we are only really using an LLM in the end after we have determined what data we want to gather and what's the key insights we want. However, that process or that strategy has to be retested on a frequent basis. What we don't want is that one alert coming in at 9 a.m. and one alert coming in at 11 a.m. doesn't have the same logic applied to it from an investigation perspective, because clients, SOC managers, CIOs, even today where we have humans doing more, we get the question, why did you not investigate those two the same way? Guess what? We had two different SOC analysts approach it slightly differently. You want consistency in a SOC. Balanced out with curiosity and slight nuance, but it's a very fine balance. We are taking that strategy both for consistency but also for cost reduction. What we're seeing is, if you just feed an alert raw into an LLM and say, investigate this for me, some of the new LLMs will do that, but the amount of tokens they burn through to do it becomes prohibitively expensive. The result will differ. Simplistically, you can ask ChatGPT or any LLM what's 2 plus 2, and they'll give you an answer. But every time you do that, you'll probably spend the same amount of money that a calculator with a solar panel costs, and that'll do it forever. Where determinism and linear logic applies, you need to use linear logic, static code, whatever. You can use a SOAR, you can use coding, you can use Python, that doesn't really matter. But where it does apply, and we're talking about, can we also have some sort of caching layer where we can regenerate it to make sure it's viable? Everybody will have their different approaches. We're looking at doing it in a cost-effective way, but also making sure we understand how things are going to be investigated. It's not a black box, because black box SOCs have made a lot of mistakes in the past.
That issue of tokens and the issue of cost and automation raises an architectural challenge. If I talk to a lot of vendors out there, everything is fired at an LLM, and everybody ignores the question of tokens. If we're trying to balance out what an individual would do, as you said, calculator with a solar panel and an individual making a decision, versus just giving it to a system, at what point do you use traditional analytic tools to do some of this? At what point do you decide, now we go to the LLM, ping, there's the token counter started? And at what point do you then go through on a regular basis and say, wow, that investigation, which turned up the same answer as this investigation, that burnt 40 tokens, this burnt 70. Why did they burn different levels of tokens? Because again, this is cost that has to be accounted for. More importantly, people are becoming much more aware of the downstream costs in terms of power, heat, and everything else outside of just the token cost.
Let's take a practical example. Malware alert comes in. Probably the well understood alert. Currently, the way we playbook it without any LLM is we fetch the file automatically. Historically, we did all this manually. We pump it into three different sandboxing technologies, which all his sandbox to ensure you don't fall for sandbox avoidance in malware, you need to run for at least 5 minutes, if not 10 minutes. In any case, you put it through that, you put it through Thread Intel. That process, having been in this game for quite a lot of years, is pretty static, and I don't see any flaws in that. The point is, I don't need an LLM to tell me every time to do that and then push the files to sandboxes itself, because I will just be burning through tokens, API calls, just make two. That is very much a good process today, and I cannot see a fault in it. So there's no reason why I'd ask the LLM to figure that one out when we know that's what it's going to do. So we'll do all of the activity first. We'll put all the IPs that comes out of the forensic analysis for you, Thread Intel engines as well, to make sure we understand if they're making connections to IP addresses that the sandboxes didn't pick up. And we layer on all the forensics. Currently, we feed all of that data into the SOC analyst, who can then say, okay, I've got three sandbox reports, I've got Thread Intel, I've got this. Is that good, bad, or indifferent? That was a playbook we built 6 years ago. It took our investigation time from 45 minutes down to 5 minutes. Obviously, there was some time spent on doing all the sandboxing and in the background, but that was all done for the SOC analyst. We didn't have a SOC analyst in waiting for the work to complete. The reality is, a little bit like our strategies, if you feed all that data into an LLM saying, okay, we had a suspicious detection from one EDR, we fed that into three above board sandbox technologies, which are really good. We took VirusTotal Thread Intel in, probably the most common virus related thread intel source, and that an LLM should be able to look at and say, we can see a verdict. We have a very basic traffic light system. If the EDR tool is so suspicious, i.e. yellow, and it's green, well, I don't think a SOC analyst could take a malware apart and forensically do more with it than we've already done. It becomes extremely subjective, but we can actually say, great, that is not a malicious malware, and we can release it back out for people to contain. However, if any of them comes out red, our rule is, okay, now we need to go and look, Mr. SOC Analyst and Mrs. SOC Analyst, and you need to make a more subjective evaluation, because the binary outcomes of deep forensic tools will not do it. Right now, I'm feeding that to a SOC Analyst, but if you fed the same amount of data, which is in one prompt saying, this is the outcome of the report, here it is, here's the outcome of this report, I could probably get a pretty 99% of the time a reasonable outcome and analysis that I can include and send to a customer. But I'm only doing one prompt. I'm not asking it to do the entire investigation. That's the concept we're looking at to drive down token count. What we don't know yet in our testing is if each alert will be different, the amount of data it will gather will be different, the amount of insights which will be derived. So we're analyzing what will be our average token count across a spectrum, and then we'll see, can we put this into effect We also will have a training feedback loop for the engine to make sure that our SOC analyst will discern whether some cases are not necessarily collated correctly by the AI. But we'll always end up having eyes on. We're very focused on the tokens because we have had quotes for autonomous tooling where, frankly, it was a lot cheaper to hire analysts than it was to buy the tool because they're guessing how their architecture is. They're burning through so many tokens in the back end.
Now, that takes us into a really complicated area and a very sensitive area for a lot of people. LLMs work best when they're trained and tuned. Any system works best when it's trained and tuned. But people are very sensitive when it comes to SOC work. As an MSSP, you've got all these customers. They don't want data shared. But if you're not training on their data, then in many cases you're repeating huge amounts of work the same. How do you achieve data separation from customers and anonymize the investigation in such a way that you can train and tune the LLM to speed up performance across the whole business and all the customers, but without running the risk of privacy and customer concerns?
That's a good question. First and foremost, I had my DevOps team starting to play, and in the end, I just said, stop. We need one model that we can work up against that we put into an environment which we think are production ready, because I don't want tons of testing happening with arbitrary models downloaded off Hugging Face where we would then have to backtrack in backstep. We've taken ChatGPT's model and put it on Microsoft Foundry so it runs in our cloud. We're not trusting any other cloud. That also means we can process in the UK, which helps me with data sovereignty, that helps me with a lot of clients. Critical national infrastructure, government, military, and various other organizations have legal requirements for data sovereignty. We are even seeing UK enterprise, probably due to geopolitical situations, are mandating UK data sovereignty these days. So we are trusting Microsoft, but it's in our cloud, and we know where it is. We created a secure environment to test up against. The second part of that is, I don't necessarily want to train the model, because coming back to my first point, I want to understand the outcomes we're going to get, and I want to have the ability to change the outcomes. Whereas if I start training the model, the outcome we're getting day one will not be the outcome we get 12 months from now. It'll dynamically change its results. So we are going to most likely do, let's call it training upgrades, tweaks that we manually instigate when we're finding flaws in investigations. Because again, coming back to consistency, if I'm going to trust at some point to do deterministic containment, there can't be any subjectivity on when that will happen, or we'll suddenly see production systems for big online retailers being taken down because our model has suddenly changed its view of the world. But at this point, the way I see it is we'll have fixed points, whether it's monthly or quarterly, where we'll review the training, whether we'll update it, whether we'll take a new model in. I also think increasingly we'll probably have several models running in parallel for fiscal resilience, for operational resilience, but also just looking at outcomes and saying, actually, do we get even ChatGPT releasing a new model that we can pump into Foundry? We won't just naturally pump it in. We'll run in parallel. We'll do comparative analysis. We might pull Gemini in. We might pull Anthropic in if we can put it on UK soil at some point. But I'm not keen on the idea of dynamically changing. Does that mean that I won't keep up with the market? Maybe, but you need to be slightly conservative with security, and especially when you are proactively containing, because it can be very disruptive for clients if you do it in the wrong way. My gut feel is we'll continue to only do updates and training as and when we manually release it. It'll be a release cycle as opposed to organic.
You talked there about not training. If we weren't talking AI and we were talking about your SOC analysts, you'd be training. You'd be teaching them, you'd be expecting them to learn from what they've seen before, and they would take that knowledge in their head. You can't unlearn a piece of knowledge out of your head to approach something completely new. It's always going to be there. In many cases in security, it's those obscure things at the back of your head when you're trying to work through a problem, you suddenly say, do you know, wasn't there something I saw a year ago about this? And you'll go, light bulb moment. If you're not going to apply a degree of training into the model in that same way, and I understand why you're not doing that, what implication does that have for you from a cost continuation perspective? Because you're, again, repeating something again and again and again, which costs money. If it's not learning, then there's a risk that it won't see something that it's seen before and therefore accelerate time to remediation.
Currently, the way I see it is I want to bring down my investigation time from 19 minutes to 5 minutes, average investigation time. That's a 75% efficiency gain from my perspective. In the short term, if I can get to that, I will be running one of the most efficient SOCs in Europe. So I'm okay with that outcome. But I think what we will end up doing is saying, okay, on a monthly basis, Mr. AI, whatever model we're running, look through the last 500,000 cases you've run, or this alert type, check the investigation strategy. Do we still think that's the right strategy? And see whether we can find deviations in their learnings. But I would then do a static release saying, okay, great, change strategy. We've now updated the strategy, and these are the outcomes we're expecting now, instead of doing it organically. Because my worry is that you'll get this slow slide in certain cases towards something that could have detrimental effects. And my bigger worry with training is that it'll increasingly show false positive, because that it will be learning. This alert type is a false positive. If you put it into a learning mode and you're using any statistical, which, let's be honest, AI is a summarization of everything it knows. If you teach an AI that 99.9% of the time, guess what, it's false positives, because that's the truth in the world we live in. It might just come to a conclusion everything's a false positive, because statistically it's very probable that it's a false positive. It's also why most people don't know their SOC provider is rubbish until the day something is not a false positive, because 1 in 1,000 or 1 in 10,000, they're absolutely right. They can just keep saying false positives. They don't even need to do any work because they're right. Some people might trade on luck on that. You know, your MSSP is perfect until the day you have a breach. Or your SOC's perfect. It doesn't even need to be an MSSP. From my perspective, maybe I'll change it. Maybe we'll have a secondary engine that will validate and check strategies on a flying basis and highlight it to a DevOps teams. But the reality is, in our organization now, we spend more money on DevOps engineers than we do actual SOC analysts. That's where the quality is. It's better playbooks, better detection logic, better alerting, better automation is where the quality of the SOC is. The SOC analyst needs to be trained and orchestrated and, but the balance with AI is probably sliding even more so over to the DevOps teams, are the ones who ensure the SOC quality exists.
If you think about a traditional database-driven type model, we'd update. When a new version of software comes out, we unload data, reload data. It's easy. It's not so easy with AI LLM models. You talked about potentially using more than one model. We've got to think about the next generation. The speed of new models is accelerating. And with that comes new reasoning features, new ways of talking to it. Last week we saw Anthropic turn around and say, oh no, you still need to be very, very prescriptive in terms of what you ask. And ChatGPT say, no, just let my model do the reasoning for you. But you've got this corpus of knowledge that you've built up of attacks, of alerts, of solutions. How do you bring a new model or a new version of a model up to speed? Do you have a separate meta file and you feed it? Do you just say, okay, doesn't matter that the model's changed. Doesn't matter this is a new version. We carry on as we were because we've not done anything to the previous version to configure it or to make it unique.
The training data set is easy because we've got millions of historic cases that have been investigations. If we really wanted to do that, right now we are testing the conceptual quality in a secure way to see whether we want to release it, even not in to do deterministic, but just to actually get the SOC analyst to review and assess the quality of the outputs to see whether it was something we can put into production. How we lifecycle that and how we evolve that is the next stage. We've even already debated should we have a secondary model running, because we've gone with ChatGPT, but guess what? They might increase that price by 5x, and suddenly my business case for doing it might diminish quite quickly. Should I have a competitive model just so I can negotiate with them? Maybe. Most likely, is my view. But in a world that's moving as fast as you said, tons of models launch, it would be remiss of us not to continually test new models as they're coming out. I'm not too worried about the training data because we got tons of training data if we really wanted to train them. But the findings we're having that in an untrained generic reasoning model from ChatGPT, it comes out with really good outputs. We can analyze a ton of forensic data that we've gathered and put out a very succinct summary, including supplementary notes and recommendations, that looks very credible on a relatively small test set so far. And we need to test that at scale. We will be in a place where we will be looking at how do we adopt the new models, how do we train them, how do we ensure the consistency when doing that, the release cycle of whether it's new models or even the same model but version 6.2, we're going to have the same problem. We're going to have to test it very thoroughly for consistency. Obviously, we got the benefit of the historic data, so we could say, please do a batch of the last 10,000 cases we've done, and then do a comparative between investigation of the old one and the new one, and look at the outcomes. We do a basic comparison, say, where are the deviations, and then look through the deviations. The same thing if we change the strategy. We can run old versus new, and we can check at volume how it works. There's plenty of things, but obviously, it's a brave new world. Things are moving very fast, and we're taking prudent steps. Once we put this into production, the next steps will be, okay, how do we maintain it in production? How do we keep updating it? How do we stay on top of it? Because the other thing, which we haven't even touched upon, is we have always had a very data-rich environment. Clients are given online reporting portal with tons of forensic data, tons of case data, and it's real-time. But they always ask this interesting question, what does it mean? They want a weekly update saying, what are our trends? If the reality is, coming back to the original cost point, if I put a data analyst on it to produce an insights weekly for every client, I would need to get £400,000 of salaries in to do that. But we are looking at, again, could we derive statistical insights from clients? Where have they got their risk, which we're now leaning ourselves into? Okay, where's the exposures in your environment? Where are the gaps? You know, are we missing phishing training? Are we seeing a lot of vulnerabilities? Are we seeing an increase in particular malwares? Malware being tested? Or even those malwares, where they're coming from, which users got it? And again, AI will play into that to inform the defensive side of where to go next and go more over to exposure management for risk surface reduction. Sorry, and I'll pivot it completely over to another discipline which we weren't talking about, but we are in a brave new world. We're testing aggressively, but we're not deploying aggressively. For us, it's about finding something that is a secure, stable, predictable, consistent way of delivering SOC.
That pivot is where I was going to go next anyway, with actionable intelligence. It's a phrase that always makes me laugh. I've seen actionable intelligence from lots of security companies. I'm not particularly naive around this industry after 40 years of doing security. I look at some of these actionable intelligences that are sent out to people and I go, I have no clue what you expect me to do with this, let alone the average IT guy in a mid to small size business who goes, I don't even understand the words. How do we make actionable intelligence simple, informative, and usable? Is it by giving them just a simple set of scripts and say, right, put the computer down, print this off, and go and do A, B, C, D, E, F, and then repeat that on this machine and then do something else on another machine? Or do we now start to say, if we want truly reactive and even proactive actionable intelligence, we need as a SOC to be much more integrated into your systems so that as we spot it, we make the change? Because that becomes quite a challenge point for a lot of organizations in terms of security and control.
Yes, is the simple answer to that. If you're looking at the evolution of security over the last 20, 30 years, we very much started in the early days. First thing, firewalls came along. Basic protection was NAT, just to make sure you couldn't see IP addresses. But then came access control rules. Now we have identity-based rules and firewalls. It was protective, and then some antivirus came along as the first malwares came along. The world then pivoted to observability, EDR, data forensics, and managed detection response, and it was all about see it, fix it. Response from a SOC context is all about containment after the event. It's not about proactive. It still baffles me when I meet organizations where the SOC actually cannot take a containment action. People think containment action is like, yeah, turn the whole network off. No, it's much simpler than that. It's password resets is the best containment action you can do, because worst case, you annoy a user. Worst case, you annoy a CEO if you reset their password. But phishing and identity breaches is where most attacks start. If you just have a really trigger-happy SOC that keeps resetting passwords, the likelihood is that you might not know it, but you might have stopped an early breach. Getting your SOC to do early containment, but we're still a reactive here, is really good. It could also be password verification, MFA re-authentication. There's lots of really good non-intrusive ways where the security controls and the IT controls, the CIO and the IT teams won't get too panicky about it. Obviously, if your password reset all the time and you become an obstacle for users doing work, yes, but then you need to dial it back. But it's a good discipline. Device containment, device controls, server containment, you're into something that could be truly obstructive to the organization and the business rules, policies, procedures. We build out this concept of authority to contain with our clients, and that's very much rules around what can we contain, device groups we're allowed to contain, device groups we're not allowed to contain. Again, you don't reset the password on a service account because guess what? It can't do self-service and it'll take down some syncing somewhere, some process. You can be granular, but it's all about increasing that speed to remediate. But if you then move over to proactive, which I think is where the industry needs to go, we're seeing SOC and CTEM merging. I don't mean CTEM in a product fashion. I mean having a program of reducing attack surfaces, of reducing your exposures is key because, firstly, if you have good vulnerability data, I'm not talking CVEs, I'm talking about exposure data feeding into your SOC. Firstly, the quality of the investigations, if they know they're looking at an alert on an asset that sits in an exposed attack path, the likelihood is the SOC analyst, and maybe in the future the LLM, will derive that this is something that needs to be contained and it's much more critical than an arbitrary alert on something that's not really vulnerable will definitely help the responsiveness of the SOC. But exposures needs to be reduced because we're seeing an organic increase of alerts happening every year. That is because people's surfaces are increasing every year. With cloud, with home working, with tons of new technologies being introduced all the time, SaaS introducing a huge work surface for people and attackers to go after, we need to start thinking about reducing that attack surface. From my perspective, should the SOC be patching proactively? Maybe not, but we talk to clients about you might not want to patch it, but you've got smart EDR tools where you could put application-based firewall rules in place. And the SOC, there's no reason saying, okay, we're seeing something that could be an exposure on a particular piece of software on a laptop. We can contain the software from accessing the internet, which means you stopped it. Obviously, those are tactical remediations that helps you before a patch process or a exposure process gets in. Coming back to actionable intelligence, the vulnerability management industry has flooded people with so much information where the majority of it was never exploitable, usable. The other thing that comes in is proactive testing. There is a number of ways today that you can identify truly exploitable exposures in your infrastructure through testing. Those are, if you're talking about a bucket that leaks, those are the huge holes that you want to plug. It's not the small cracks that are harder to get at. But you want to highlight that to your IT organization. And I do think if you've tested an exploit and you can go and prove to a server administrator saying, we managed to get to that domain controller, we jumped through here, we did this, and you actually show the attack path and the scripts that's been done, that IT admin will respond nicely. If you go and tell them, say, well, you got 200,000 9.0 CVEs, which are critical, so needs to be patched across your infrastructure, he'll look at a piece of work that, frankly, he couldn't do in the next 12 months, let alone the next 2 years, and it's not relevant. Those are not the ones the attackers will exploit. Generally, they'll come in via an identity exploit or identity breach. They'll land somewhere and they'll find the easy exploits to get access to systems, to get themselves landed into some sort of persistent remote access, and then they go from there. Fixing those big holes alongside a relatively proactive SOC will ultimately reduce the ability for people to breach organizations. It's coming back to actionable intelligence. How do you get at it? Well, several things. Testing, but also correlation of all your exposure data. A lot of people have some CNAPP tool, say Wiz, the leader. They have vulnerability management from Qualys or Tenable, as an example. They have telemetry coming out of their Microsoft estate. Quite often it lives in 6 or 7 different places, and they should never meet. This is one of the things we talk about. Aggregate that data, making sure you understand which asset sits in all databases or all of it. And we say to people, it's like a big Venn diagram. You really want to start focusing on things that are in the middle. Frankly, if you then start proactively testing everything, you'll find that that's where your real problems are and what could really be exploited, because if it's exposed on the internet and there's a vulnerability and there's a misconfiguration in your IIS, then guess what? Someone will find a way in.
You mentioned Qualys there, and we've had Qualys talk about the Risk Operations Center for some time, and that's more about understanding this large number of vulnerabilities and what actually applies to you. The NCSC last Friday pushed out this paper on a Friday, for goodness sake, called Preparing for Vulnerability Patch Wave. I'm not sure quite who they thought was going to read it by pushing it on a Friday, but I'll guarantee it's a very small number of people compared to who should be reading it. We are overwhelmed, and we have been overwhelmed for 2, if not 3 decades by the number of patches that pour into our organisation. We lost that war. We cannot patch at that rate. We used to test patches. Now we just blindly let them go in most organisations, and they cause unforeseen consequences. But most of those patches, in truth, don't apply to a lot of organisations in terms of do now. They can be scaled in. When you're talking to clients and you're looking at that vulnerability, are you saying to them, right, this is the levels of vulnerability. We've seen this one. This is quite critical because it gets to here. These ones are a problem because anybody who gets in and starts living off the land can exploit these. And then help them, if necessary, by giving them a list of how to start approaching it, because organizations don't know where to start.
What we offer clients is saying, why don't we aggregate all your data so you have a holistic view on which assets appear everywhere, so you can see the combined entity. Qualys and Tenable are very good at enriching the individual vulnerabilities, but is often not contextually aware. While both of them now offer the ability to put some sort of organizational context in, it doesn't play nicely with WIST data or CrowdStrike CNAPP data or SentinelOne CNAPP data or Microsoft vulnerability data and exposure data. We can combine all of that data for you so you get a holistic view. What they end up having is quite often an actual CMDB with all the assets in, because once you take all of that data in, you have a pretty complete view. And I'm surprised we live in a world where we can have a complete CMDB, maybe. Because let's be honest, most organizations actually don't know what assets they've got. If you start there with accepting it's a visibility thing, that means you can feed it into some sort of CTEM program, because you now know the total picture of your exposures. If you go back to the vulnerability piece, unbeknown to most people is, it changes all the time. Roughly 1% to 2% of all known vulnerabilities are actually exploitable, which means the rest of them are very theoretical. If you then overlay internet-connected, non-internet-connected devices, or directly internet-connected devices, i.e. servers, there is a whole heap of things you can rule out. That simple analysis will tell you where to focus. But if you then go for technology, there's a few on the market, and maybe Mythos, who knows, it might be a good PR campaign, it might be, it's truly as amazing as it is, but there's a lot of technologies on the market, including one we work with, it's called Horizon 3, that does proactive testing of exploitables and will tell you where you actually can be breached. It doesn't scan all the CVEs that can't be exploited, it'll only go for that lower number. If you do a full vulnerability scan on a big estate, it'll take you weeks. If you do it only on exploitables, it can be done in minutes or a day in a big estate, which means you can then finally identify things that could actually be breached. Sometimes call it real vulnerabilities. That's not a technical term. Then you can focus your energy there. But as we all know, exposures of vulnerabilities is a game of whack-a-mole. You knock them down, then new ones pop up. Patch Tuesday always reveals more. But then it's important to advise your board or whoever you're reporting to, saying it's not the quantum that's the interesting thing, it's actually the dwell time. How long have you got it? Have you got a healthy process for managing them? If the average dwell time of vulnerability in your organization is less than a week, you're doing really well. It might be you have 200 million of them, but that's just because last Tuesday another 50 or 100 arrived. You need to go proactive. You need to differentiate between a good cadence of patching to the things that are truly things that need to be fixed now as an emergency. If you start thinking in good process versus emergency, but emergency has to be proven issues, not theoretical issues, you can get into a pretty good proactive thing. It's that proven vulnerabilities, pulling it all the way back to the actionable intelligence question. It's actionable intelligence if it's proven that it's an issue. If it's a theoretical issue, then it's not actionable intelligence. And it's the same with the SOC. If we can see exploits being done and we tell clients about it, that's actionable intelligence. It's later than artificial exploits that are being done by testing, because it's being tested in a real-world scenario, which is less fortunate. But nevertheless, it turns into actionable intelligence. Then there is all the way back to trending of what's happening in the SOC, taking the trends of what's going on to figure out where are the weaknesses emerging in the organization, because it's an organic picture and there will be a change over time where you'll see more attacks coming in.
I'm aware we're short of time. I've got two last questions for you. The reason for my question just now was where we've seen AI come into other services organizations. The assumption behind it has been that it will free people up to do more. Accountancy, for example, AI's coming in, automation's coming in, it will free accountants up to be closer to their clients and offer them new services. So the idea of being able to offer better vulnerability advice from risk seemed to make sense to me from a SOC perspective. But then so does red teaming. And at what point do SOCs start to use red teams or offer red team services to clients?
That's interesting. I'm not sure whether you read our website before this, because funnily enough, we launched purple teaming. We didn't launch red teaming. We have stayed away from pen testing red teaming because we always saw ourselves as a blue team. But increasingly, we found that when we were doing purple teaming with third-party red team organizations, they saw it as a combative exercise to try and get one over on the SOC, which wasn't very useful, because we would say, okay, you did all of that. Great. There's your report. Fine, we saw 70% of everything you did, but the last 30%, we would like to delve into that. What did you actually do here? What scripts were you running? Because we can't find the telemetry or whatever happened. Quite often when we work with third parties, they come up with, oh, it's our IP and it's our knowledge and we can't share it. We, funny enough, last year said we'll go into purple teaming with our own red teamers. The difference twofold is, as soon as our red teamer finds a gap and an issue and a breach, they'll tell the client, saying, well, firstly, we found this issue on your service, that there's a gap here. Secondly, they'll also tell the blue teams and the engineering team, saying, no alert triggered for this, it should have. And real time, they go and say, well, what telemetry should have been generated? What detection logic should have been in place? Or the detection logic, the telemetry was generated, the detection logic didn't work, or the detection logic worked, but the SOC didn't triage it correctly because the automation failed. There's a number of reasons why that would be. And then it becomes very cyclical. Say, okay, we fixed it, retest it. Because for us, it's much more about moving your entire posture up, not trying to prove the SOC doesn't work. As a SOC provider, you would probably always say that, but we found it's been much more productive because the client still gets told about lots of red teaming issues and vulnerabilities in infrastructure and identity problems and passwords that are published. At the same time, once they're done, say, well, there's all the issues, but okay, whether you fixed it on your IT side or not, if someone came in and did it, we can now prove that we detected all and we'll let you know or stop it, contain it. We're finding that that is the case. We have historically stayed away from it, but very much going all in on purple teaming. And clients are like, well, no, it's supposed to be adversarial. And I said, we don't get the point. You get all the knowledge of everything we find anyway, so you get your red team, but you actually get a SOC that improves more than if you do it with a third party. Pen testing, I think it's a compliance activity, never been particularly useful. It's a little bit like vulnerabilities. It's a mass scan and it produces a big report and everybody panics. Red teaming and SOC, meaning purple teaming, goes hand in hand these days. We also increasingly having clients say, can we do it as a continuous exercise? We run it quarterly. The other thing we're finding is, and this is where, again, the third-party red team would know it, the red team has suddenly identified infrastructure that's not monitored. And that's because the SOC has never been told that infrastructure even existed. Frankly, the most issues we see in red teaming exercise quite often when there's 200 servers that somebody forgot about in a data room somewhere, which surprisingly happens every week, that they identify that. But again, it then goes into the monitoring. Breaches might be found. It might be forgotten infrastructure full of vulnerabilities that are exploitable. But you achieve a lot more by proper purple teaming is our finding so far.
Right at the beginning, I said, the AI SOC. Is it our savior? Is it a distraction? Is it a work in progress? If I stood you on a stage now in front of 500 potential customers, what would you say?
I would say it's a work in progress. It's a leveler, but it doesn't take us ahead of the darker side of cyber because they also have all the toolings. It's probably more an advantage. I do think it'll create benefits, without a doubt. We're already seeing it in testing. We're already seeing it in many places. We're already seeing things speeding up. Do I see an AI SOC where everything is AI? Categorically not. We've already seen attacks where AI has been used. AI can never only look backwards. It's trained on historic data. There is no curiosity, which it takes to be a good SOC analyst. I cannot see a scenario where AI will do everything. And the day the AI does everything, guess what? Another AI will figure out how to avoid it. It's classic security. As soon as you elevate your security posture, someone else figures out how to break it. And there will always be have to be a human in the loop at some point. Job descriptions will change. A SOC will probably go for having even more engineering AI engineers than SOC analysts, and that's okay. The balance of where effort's put in. I also think people shouldn't underestimate how much effort it takes to plumb in an AI. A good AI SOC analyst will need 10, 15 connected systems to operate properly. going all the way back to Siem, one of the biggest challenges with Siem has always been the plumbing. Same with SOAR, and you're going to have all the same problems with the AI. We will see jobs changing, we'll see workloads move around, we will see things speed up. But is it the savior? No, I don't see it.
Martin, thank you very much for today.